listening to By the Well, a lectionary podcast for preachers to help you preach the good news in your communities. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker. We're in Pentecost 23, and this week we'll be discussing Joshua 24, verses 1 to 25, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, 13 to 18, and the parable in Matthew 25, 1 to 13. Fran, let's start with Joshua 24, yes, which is the second of his farewell speeches, kind of a wrap-up.
Yeah, and this is one where I'd say to preachers, I'd really recommend reading the verses that the lectionary wishes to leave out.
Yes.
So the lectionary says go 1 to 3a and then 14 to 25, but verses 4 to 13 are just this wonderful account of the history of the Israelites since Abraham.
Yeah.
And it's a really rich account, and it's, as we've talked about before, it depicts God with loads of verbs doing lots and lots of things. And I think a lot of the power of the passage is lost if you leave that out. It will make for a longer reading, but if it's read well, I think it's probably better in the long run.
I agree with that, because I think part of what this passage shows us, that something preachers could pick up to sort of jump to themes straight away, is that here we have modelled for us what it looks like to recount your story. Mm. Like throughout the Bible, there are these retellings of this is our story, these are your, the language here is you and your, it's very personal. It's not some ancient people we didn't know. This is your story, and this is the way God has been involved in it. And there's something really powerful there as a reminder to us about how, or a challenge perhaps, about how good we are at telling our stories. But
one thing I want to, can I point out about that you and your, so something I was reading talked about the rhetoric in Hebrew, and that actually here you've got interspersed you, your, and they. So this clever reference to, so the people who's been spoken to who are living now, sometimes they and sometimes you, so that they're incorporated in what happened in this history. So it's a really clever, it looks sort of sloppy. If you were marking it as an, you know, high school essay, you'd say, keep
the grammar might
with
be
your,
a problem.
Yeah, but actually super, super deliberate.
Yeah.
And it really does occur to me. And I know, you know, if you celebrated All Saints last week, fantastic. I'd say you could do it again with this passage actually.
Yeah.
And how it accounts for the community of faith over time and how they contribute to our identity and our understanding under God.
And, I mean, it's worth noting that a central verse here is the reminder that this God, the one they're being asked to choose, and that's really the, you know, there's a choice to be made here by the people, but this God is the one who liberated them. So we talked about this when we were in the Exodus passages, that this Exodus story, the God who brought us and our ancestors from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery, it is that God, that is the dominant kind of way of talking about God in much of the Hebrew Bible. God
and
is
also
liberator.
Yeah, and great provider as well, because at the end of these lot verses that the lectionary wants to leave out, I gave you the land on which you had not laboured and towns that you hadn't built, and I let you eat fruit from the vineyards that you didn't plant. So there's all this sort of gift, abundant grace and gift as well, which is all under that freedom as well.
Yeah. Now, do we need to acknowledge the problem right there?
I mean, you know, those of us reading this passage now will really hopefully increasingly, really be a bit disturbed by the genocide that lies behind what's happening here and the colonial taking of lands. So I think that preachers really must point that out. It doesn't empty the radicality and the profundity of the theological stuff that's going on here, but I do think it would be remiss not to note. So all of this history is underpinned by God, who apparently wanted to drive the Canaanites out of the land and take the land and give it to the Israelites and all the suffering that that would involve. I suppose, interestingly, we must note that that particular call to holy war didn't succeed. That we know from... where do we know that in Judges chapter 1 and 2 we know that God didn't complete the conquest?
And there are still Canaanites who live on.
They're still there not because of some modern liberal move of compassion by God, but so that they could continue to test Israel. So that's, yeah. You know, but it, so it didn't succeed. But I do think
we can't ignore that.
There's a tension in this radical depiction of God who is abundant and brings freedom, and the sort of narratives that kind of a lot historically that are lying behind it.
Yeah, and I think particularly for those of us, which is most of us in the West, who preach in contexts where we have this, you know, colonial history here in Australia. Mm-hmm. White people came and took, stole the land. There was genocide. We need to acknowledge, that this is a difficult part of the biblical tradition, and not just repeat it as if this is how God behaves glibly, yeah. Because actually then we're tying into a really problematic, more recent theology.
Yep.
We've mentioned choice here, and really Joshua is pushing the people, choose, you know, your ancestral gods or this one, the Lord, Yahweh.
Mm.
I'm struck by what a genuine choice it is.
Yeah, it's so stark. It's not it's not grey.
Yep.
You know, we do like to, the more educated we are, the more rational, well, more rationalising we like to do.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's mostly really good around the sort of lines of truth we might be being fed by dubious media and so on.
Yeah.
But here there isn't really a lot of room for rationalising. It's very clear that there's a choice, that there was life in one direction and not life-giving life in the other.
But also I like that Joshua pushes them when they're like, yeah, we choose God. And then he's like, no, you can't.
I'm reminded of Exodus 19, where on Mount Sinai they said, everything that the Lord asks we will do. And the next time we hear them speak, it's when they want the golden calf.
Yeah, that's right.
So, and that's what Joshua knows. That's what they did.
Yes.
So I think it's kind of, it's troubling, this passage too. I mean, not just on that political stuff around colonialism we've highlighted, but also it's troubling because, no, you're not. Yes, we will. No, you're not. Looks like there's not a lot of good news here. However.
Well, where would you say the good news is? Because I think this is a difficult passage, and a lot of preachers might be inclined to just ignore it this week and focus on the New Testament, which there are fantastic things we'll get to in a moment in those New Testament passages. But
Well, I guess the most stark thing is he says, no, you won't, in verse 19, and then sort of keeps on pushing in that way, just keeps saying. But actually Joshua made the covenant with the people that day.
Yes.
Anyway, like it's not like, not even did he went away for a month and thought, what are the odds? Well, okay, I'll do it. Even though he knew they wouldn't do it probably properly, he made the covenant anyway. So there's something about highlighting that all along this covenant with God has not been dependent at the end of the day on the goodness of the people and the moral rectitude of them. It's about the fidelity of God and the persistent faithfulness of God.
Yeah.
So for me, that would be what you would, that is the good news and the hope on which you would conclude.
Yeah. And I think there's a way to link this to our contemporary commitment. There's a repeated word from verse 14 on, I think it's twice in verse 14 and then three times in the next couple of verses, which is to serve, revere the Lord and serve him, this abad word in Hebrew, which can have a sense of work.
Mm-hmm.
It's where we get the word servant from, in the same root, but it also can have a sense of to worship. And so the Greek translation, the Septuagint, has lutruo, which is another service word, but one that also has a worship, like you serve in the temple is lutruo. Mm-hmm. So I say that because there's an emphasis that that's what they're committing to do. So one could ponder on what service to God looks like today, how you hold together the work and the worship, and the worship in this construction is part of the work. You know, we don't separate of service from worship in the way we sometimes do in contemporary Christianity. And the other thing I like is there's the retelling of the story, but when the choice is made, there is ritual, and then if you keep reading, Joshua places a stone. There's a symbol that marks it. Mm. And we, of course, we do this in baptism. We do it in confirmation. Mm. We do it in marriage ceremonies, recommitment. Like there's lots of ways you could use this as a chance to reflect perhaps in your community about choices.
Well,
and
you could actually
tell conversion stories, tell commitment stories.
Yeah, or you could actually just recollect your baptisms.
Yes.
The Uniting Church has quite a good liturgy for that.
Yeah, exactly.
For those of you in the Uniting Church.
Yeah.
That would be a really good way to live out that passage, I think. So
great.
Should we move on to Thessalonians?
We should, which I felt that we had to comment on today because this is the passage from which any of you who grew up in the parts of the church that I was influenced by for a while, like the Tim LaHaye, Hal Lindsey, Left Behind kind of book series, will recognize that this is the passage from where a whole lot of rapture so-called theology comes. And I want to say this is not the rapture as it's imagined in those more contemporary Christian iterations of it. Mm. This is not escapism from the earth. No one is actually left behind.
There's no us and them. Yeah.
There's no us and them. And there's a meeting of Christ in the air and the clouds, which is arguably all symbolic for meeting kind of halfway. But, you know, there's a return to earth. All other post-life kind of iterations in the New Testament are about God dwelling on earth with humans. So it's, I want to say to people, it's worth preaching on this to actually do kind of corrective teaching.
Yeah.
Because this is beautiful and we tend to avoid it because it's associated with some really problematic Christian
it's very sort of I suppose Andrew Root talks about how the world's become disenchanted or unenchanted, this sort of imagery, and we've lost the capacity to hear it, the depth of it.
Yeah.
We dismiss it. But I'm really struck by the pastoral imperative that I think must lie behind this passage. Mm-hmm. Not when is the Son of God coming, or when is the Son of Man coming, which is what Matthew will be taking up in a conversation in a minute.
In a moment.
But it's not when, it's not when is this going to happen, but when it does, you won't be separated from those you love. You're separated now, but you won't be. You'll be reunited. So I feel like there's a huge pastoral thing behind here, behind this passage.
Yeah, I agree.
And
it's expressed very starkly in verse 13 and in the Greek with, you know, I don't want you to be ignorant about death and resurrection, and I don't want you to be a community, you know, who don't have hope like other people.
No, because we've got to remember that Paul's in a context that's Greek and Roman, lots of other gods, and for them, I suppose, what they're left with is you abandon yourself to the profound grief of loss, or you stoically suppress it and move through it. And what he's saying here, actually, no, because of Christ, we have a new hope. It is radically new and it is not vague, and it means that you will be reunited with those who you love who have died. And we must mention that perhaps that for the Thessalonians will be people who've died having been suppressed as Christians in the community.
That's right, yep. Could be a range of deaths. So we've got to remember this is our earliest New Testament letter or earliest New Testament writing, therefore, from Paul. We know that these early Christian communities, because we can see it being worked out on the pages of the New Testament, did think Jesus was coming back any day. And so perhaps there was a theology that no one would die until Jesus came back. And so I think the pastoral question is, what do we do with our beloved Christians who've died, have they missed out on the resurrection?
Yeah, yeah.
Are they lost to Jesus? And Paul says very clearly, no.
No.
Because Jesus died and rose, we know that when Jesus returns, he will gather up all the dead with him. Like they are not lost to God. So it's deeply pastoral.
Yeah.
Particularly during a COVID time, right? The dead are not lost to God.
No. So here, and it's an opportunity for a sermon on the resurrection.
It is.
If you only do that explicitly at Easter.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you don't just do it then. But, you know, here's one where you could go really have a bit of, spend some time.
Yeah. And it never hurts to, I think, for preachers to go back to those basics, because there are lots of pretty kooky ideas about resurrection and what happens at the end in Christianity, and that play out in wider popular belief like the Left Behind series. And if we aren't actually talking about it more deeply and pastorally, we aren't leaving our people with resources.
No.
We've got to remember too, I just want to talk about the symbolism. I mean, Paul is working off the assumption of a three-tiered universe. So this idea that Christ comes down from the heaven is, of course, tapping into Daniel and other texts that talk about the Son of Man coming in the clouds. Yeah. So that part's not astonishing at all. The astonishing part is that God gathers people up to meet this coming king. And I think the meeting halfway is quite beautiful, that it's like a people going out of the city to meet the coming emperor.
Well,
or
I was going to say, so actually it's beautiful, but it's also challenging. It's deeply subversive.
Okay, what do you
mean by
that?
Very subversive. Well, if the people are under the rule of the emperor and they're supposed to accord the emperor this sort of authority and grandeur, and actually here's Paul saying, actually you're supposed to be directing that to Jesus Christ who died and rose for you.
Yeah.
And so therefore he's transposing those images around the meeting Caesar outside the gates to Jesus, and that's why they're being persecuted. So
yeah,
I think it's very subversive.
It's
subversive and a beautiful account of how God meets us.
Yeah, and I mean, again, we can't put too much, whenever we're reading Paul's letters, we've got to really focus on what he's addressing, which is that pastoral issue you just named, Fran. This isn't an attempt to do a whole systematic theology of the end. He's not interested in the when this will happen. He doesn't map out what happens next or who's in or who's out. None of those are concerns. This is really about, don't worry, your loved ones are caught up in the promise of God for resurrection too. And this beautiful promise in verse 17, just before the end, you know, and thus, therefore, we will be with the Lord forever. This is the promise. And if we go to other parts of the Bible, like Romans 8 and Revelation 21, that forever with God is actually back down on earth, in a renewed earth, a recreated earth. So this is not an escapist living in the clouds kind of theology.
I just want to make a comment that's not directly related to that. I'm reminded I read part of the Bratsos series commentary on Thessalonians for this. I'll put the author in the show notes. But the author quotes Augustine's account of how Jesus Christ puts death to death. And Augustine's, he died, but he killed death. In himself, he put an end to what frightened us. He caught it and he killed it. Like the mightiest hunter, he seized and slew the lion. Where is death? Search in Christ, but it is not. But it was, and it died there. And that's what something about separation. Again, it's echoes of communion of the saints. So,
So in a sense, you could continue whatever conversation you started on All Souls or All Saints Day last week.
Yeah. But I really like that account from Augustine of what the significance of the death and resurrection.
Yes, which is why the resurrection would become so absolutely pivotal, even though Paul's theology and Mark, our earliest, you know, start very much with the cross and the problem. Yeah. But that's another day. Matthew 25, the 10 bridesmaids, or what we might call the 10 young women.
Yep.
And Parthenoi, they're virgins.
So we've entered the eschatological part of Matthew. Not that he hasn't been eschatological up to now. We hasten to add.
No, that's true.
This passage follows the watchfulness, the account of persecutions, the account of what happens if you're not ready and unprepared. It's got the faithful and unfaithful slave and the warning against false messiahs. So the drama's really picking up.
Yeah, it is. And we've had, like, you know, just to quote a couple of really explicit teachings before this, in 24:36, Jesus has been teaching that no one knows, not the angels or anyone, nor the Son, when that day, that coming day, the day of judgment will be. And again in 24:44, he's speaking directly to the disciples, you must be ready for the Son of Man is coming at an unexpected hour. So that's our context here.
And then, after this, the plot to kill Jesus really begins.
Yeah, that's true. And this is another parable. We've had a series of these Kingdom of Heaven is like. This is a will be like. So I think it's a bit more eschatological. This is about the future kingdom. And I want to say, again, it doesn't do everything. We need to be careful that there's three of these parables here, but they all have slightly different aspects that they draw out, and we won't see the same emphasis in all of them.
No. So something I read, I can't remember what it was made a point of the fact that the first word is then.
Yes. Then.
And this commentator said, this then, Jesus has been telling the disciples how they must live in the light of his death and resurrection. So then,
yeah,
this is what the kingdom of heaven will look like. So I just think these little words are not trivial.
Well, yeah, or I think it means a more a then at that time. Like,
at that.
Yeah.
At as that. In chronologically.
Oh, well, yes, more chronologically.
Which commentator you accept. I'm interested in Sunny Chen's little nugget.
Yes.
When I tapped into his conversation about the Greek in these passages, that the kingdom of the heavens,
mm-hmm.
which is used again here, is used 69 times in Matthew and not at all in the rest of the New Testament. And this is the last occasion on we've mentioned it before, but I wasn't aware there was as many occasions as 69. And this is the last time.
Yeah. And this is Matthew's version of kingdom of God. He doesn't say kingdom of God. It's always kingdom of heavens.
Yeah.
The heaven. And there's a few Greek things, as we've noticed, these 10, you know, in the NRSV, I think they're bridesmaids. They are really young female, unmarried female attendants
mm-hmm.
who would, Craig Keen is quite good on this in his commentary. He talks very much about the social setting. And then in ancient societies, you would have had as the wedding celebrations began, he said, you know, literally it is two families coming together, and these attendants and servants would have run back and forth as final dowries and presents and money was negotiated, and there would be a procession from one house to the other for the wedding banquet, which would then go for days. So he does paint a lovely picture of the kind of village setting in which a lot of this is very plausible. So none of that is shocking. People would have been familiar with these young attendants.
Well, it might be appropriate for me to just pop in that it would be important perhaps for your people we're preaching to just remind them that this bridal imagery does recur quite consistently through the scriptures, the Hebrew and the New Testament. And going back to Isaiah 54, where God declares his desire to be Israel's husband so that the nation shall not be barren. We know from Jeremiah 31 that they broke the covenant when I was their husband and so on. So that, and then Paul, of course, identifies the bride as the church in Corinthians and Ephesians 5. So that it's not a surprise at all that that we have a wedding banquet exemplifying what the kingdom of heaven might
look like. And if I could add one more example, at the end of Revelation, the final scene of New Jerusalem is described as a wedding feast. It is the Lamb who is the groom is there to marry all the people, which I've always thought, ironically, side note, does wonderful gender bending stuff in a text that can actually be quite sexist when you get to the book of Revelation, that actually the entire community is imagined as a bunch of women.
Wonderful. You know. So I just think that's worth pointing out that people don't necessarily see that consistency or, you know, who aren't engaged in the scriptures that much.
No, I think that's helpful because the power of this parable then is it taps into something deeply human and everyday that people can identify with, and at the same time a biblical eschatological image for what being with God would be like.
And if you're going to go back as far as Isaiah, it does connect us with Joshua and all the ancestors as well.
Exactly.
I mean, you know.
Exactly.
But it is a disturbing or troubling here, doesn't it? I mean,
it is.
For a start, perhaps our modern sensibilities might be affronted that the bridesmaids with the oil didn't share it with those without.
Doesn't seem very Christian, does it?
No, it doesn't. And I would, like, that's an understandable note from us, but that's a really liberal, moral kind of observation that I would put a caution on. That's not what this passage is. Matthew will elsewhere very clearly make moves in stories that indicate that, you know, they should have shared or the equivalent of that. But it's also that there is a sort of time limit on God's grace or something that seems to sort of counteract the loving compassion of God that has come through in Matthew, admittedly with the judgment as well, most of it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Judgment is threaded throughout here and the demands of discipleship. So I think you're right. The moral status, in whatever way we want to measure that, of these two groups of women is irrelevant. The only thing important in this passage is the readiness to meet the bridegroom, whether you're prepared for that. And so I don't even know if the issue is that they'd run out of oil. The issue is they'd run out of oil and then run to the shops to buy more, or the metaphor, so that they're not there when he comes. Yeah, they've stopped watching.
Yeah.
And so, that's again, the point. Yeah, it's so important that we see this framed as all by all those commands to the disciples to watch, because that is actually the problem here. And, I mean, it ends with verse 13, keep awake, you don't know the day, or, you know,
And I'm reminded in Matthew 24 when the disciples obviously went to sleep. Not 24, 26, obviously, around the crucifixion.
Yeah, in Gethsemane, fail to keep watch.
Yeah, it's a recurring.
Yeah. The other thing to note, there's a nice little comment that, again, I got from Keener. He talks about the sort of judgment when the five young women who were not ready get kind of locked out and the door is shut in their face, and they've knocked on the door saying, Master, Master, and what they get is an I don't know you.
Yes, and you're a stranger.
Yes, and Keener says this is about that stranger thing. It's about someone who should be known, but because of their actions, they are no longer recognised as part of the group. So the othering of I don't know you is actually, it's not that they're not known, it's that they've become known.
They've made themselves strangers.
And that is a powerful, I think, warning that is at the heart of this parable. That you don't want to knock on the door and be greeted with, I don't know you, because you weren't there to greet me. Mm. So, I mean, it is a demanding parable, shall we say. I think it is supposed to disturb and shock us in some way.
Is there, what's the good, I'm just thinking what the good news is.
Yes, so that we don't end on that note.
You know, I mean,
well, I think the good news is, for those who are ready, you are welcomed into this abundant, extravagant wedding banquet with the bridegroom that you've been waiting for, who, even if, and I mean, the delay here is interesting because, you know, that might go to Paul's concern in 1 Thessalonians. Mm. Even if the bridegroom hasn't come back when we thought he would, our community's still waiting. There's been a delay, but there's a don't give up hope, keep watching, Jesus will come. And so I think the good news is, for those who are faithful and maintain that hope, there is, you know, an abundant feast with God, an intimate feast, which, who does know you?
Yeah, I mean, that is good news, but then I'm troubled that we worship a God who doesn't give us what we deserve in all senses, so therefore those who aren't watching will actually be embraced in the end anyway.
Yeah, and again, the readiness is simply about watching. There's a sense of keep your eye on the prize, to use a glib phrase.
Yeah.
But the reward is for being ready, not, which does say something about priorities, but it doesn't, again, say anything about your morality in life and whether you're a kind person. That's just not a concern, which is why we need to put this alongside. You know, it's why we have the whole gospel.
Yes, exactly.
But the good news is not entirely found here. It's a little part of it.
Yeah, yeah. And that we are living in this waiting time.
Yep.
And we are called to accept the invitation and be part of the kingdom and participate in the new world. And that's great news. Great. And a great note to end, perhaps.
It is. You've been listening to By the Well, a podcast brought to you by the Uniting Church in Australia and Pilgrim Theological College.
Thanks for listening.